You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Tin Man. I'm Colin from Warwickshire in England.
And I'm Chris, a.k.a. Kieran, from Glasgow in Scotland.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. Grateful that Chris didn't read he was James from location. It's another glitch. I did that. I just noticed that. Now, if it was Ben, he would have read it exactly as it's written.
I thought about it. It's confusing enough. I've got two names, so I didn't want to make it a thumb.
Absolutely. So,
Chris, and Chris, now you live in Glasgow.
Yes.
Have you done the whiskey tour?
No, I'm not a whiskey man.
I've been invited by someone to do the whiskey tour in Glasgow.
I've heard.
I don't know what I'm letting myself in for.
Chris, I was actually about to say that given that you're Scottish, is your middle name at least not James?
No.
Oh.
No, it's not.
Now I've met everything.
That's not stereotyping at all.
Well, are you suggesting that aren't that many Jims in Glasgow?
No. It's very rare.
Very rare.
It's very rare.
Sure.
No, actually, I was looking at the new Rocky movie trailer. He told me there's a new Rocky Balboa movie, so...
Yeah, Creed. That's about
Creed.
Apollo's son.
Yeah, I gotta check it out.
Oh, definitely. I seen a trailer for that a few weeks ago when I went to see Spectre. And Matt Hansen was telling me earlier today how brilliant it is. So, definitely need to see that.
Cool. Okay, so, Colin and Chris. Colin, let's see. When did we last have you on? It's been a while, hasn't it?
It has been a while, yeah.
The Enemy. You were on for The Enemy. What have you been doing since... Well, I guess it was August. Not too long ago. So what have you been up to lately?
Not a lot, really, because as people who follow me on Twitter will know, my dad took ill.
Yeah.
And he passed away in October. So basically my time's been tied up with that. So I haven't been doing anything else apart from going back and forward to the hospital and then taking care of things afterwards.
Yeah. Well, you know, our condolences to you. I know what it's like. I talked about my dad last show, and it's been 10 years since we lost him. And it was 3 days ago, in fact. And Thanksgiving is always a difficult time for us because... he died the day after Thanksgiving, which was also my daughter's birthday. And we found our mom unconscious on Thanksgiving. She died about 2 years after that. So Thanksgiving is very difficult, but we're still thankful because they were two incredible people. So I'm sure your dad was incredible as well. So,
sorry, I'd like to take this opportunity to everyone on Twitter and Google Plus for all their kind messages, and also to you and James Lou for the emails the other day.
You bet. And Chris, what about you? What have you been up to since the last time we talked to you, which was Booby Trap?
I've been on holiday. I went to Florida for a few weeks. Well, a couple of weeks. I mean, it was nice to get away from the horrible wind and rain you get here and getting some nice... Actually, record high temperatures in Florida at some point. So they were hitting almost 90.
Really?
Which isn't bad for November.
So you were in Florida, huh? You were in the States. I felt a disturbance in the force. Something was going on here. Couldn't identify what, but now we know. And
apt choice of words, given I was at Disney most of the time, and they obviously own Star Wars now.
And then, James, you're coming here next year for Star Trek Las Vegas?
Absolutely.
Yes. And I found out recently my sister wants to go to Las Vegas, but we're going in March, not in August. Part of me wants to save up a few bucks and maybe try and get back in August and see if I can at least go one day of the convention.
I'm very jealous, James.
Why?
Well, it's the 50th anniversary. That's going to be unbelievable next year.
Mm.
Oh, I mean, it's still far enough in the future that it's that I'm not really thinking about it too much, but I'm certainly in a position where we can what certainly we can head out over there, and then, you know, hopefully everything will just take care of itself in terms of logistics. But I'll have a what I will announce when I have flights and tickets booked.
Yeah, the synopsis for tonight's episode is: the Enterprise races against Romulans to make first contact with a powerful entity codenamed Tin Man. This is the 20th episode of Season 3 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original release date is April the 23rd, 1990. It was written by Dennis Putman Bailey and David Biscoff, and directed by Robert Schrier. Guest stars include Michael Kavanagh as Captain Robert DeSarto, who is Riker's old boss. Harry Gruner as Tam Albrum, Peter Vaught as Romulan Commander, and Colin Meaney as Miles O'Brien, because someone's got to stand in a transporter room.
So what do we think about this episode?
You know, before we go into what do we think about this episode, which job is more boring, the officer in the transporter room or the officer in the brig?
Oh, it must be the officer in the brig, surely. There's not many people get thrown in the brig.
No, and at least the transporter officer has maintenance to do in that.
Do you think it's possible at all to beam a sleeping Picard from his quarters into Troy's quarters so they both wake up and wonder what the hell happened?
I would think so. I think it's possible.
Or do you think that would wake someone up? What's that?
They do site-to-site transports in the show, so yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, but would it wake someone up to be beamed from one location to another?
Well, I don't know. I suppose it depends on how heavy a sleeper they are.
Mm.
Yeah, but both in Insurrection, right, and in Homeward, they beamed, or these plants beam colonists away while they sleep in and pretend that they were kind of, you know, going on an adventure. So it must be possible.
That's true. Yeah, they was going to beam them all onto the Hollow ship, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. You wake up the next morning on this holodeck and you would never know. And then finally they just plop you on this planet and you go, how the hell did we get here?
I'm pretty certain that's happened to me twice already in my life.
Really?
Was alcohol involved?
God. Boy, would I love to hear the explanation for that. Okay.
Was one of these during your student days, James?
I just remember when I was a kid, it didn't snow as much. Whereas now it snows more or less every year in London. It's, you know, something subtly changed. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, at least once a year. You guys are so lucky. You know that? I got to be honest. You're lucky. On my front deck right now is a sheet of ice that I can't figure out for the life of me how I'm supposed to melt this stuff. You can't use ice melt on a wood deck. It rots the joists and the supports or whatever. So what am I supposed to do with this?
Rock salt.
Can't use it. Calcium chloride. The calcium or whatever in it, it rots the wood and it rots the supports for the wood.
What about sand?
I was thinking
that. What about gently making it warmer? I mean, I don't know.
I guess. What did the Enterprise use to make the sun brighter or hotter or something?
No, that's what you need, Luke. You need a phaser.
Yeah, I was thinking a phaser on the low setting.
Just, yeah. And we can add melty phase, warm up rock, cook, and ice beam.
See, the problem there, it would melt the ice, but then it would refreeze. And it'd probably be worse. But yeah, I was actually thinking sand. Throw some sand down, at least we might be able to walk with a little traction.
And James isn't actually that lucky, because Scotland has really bad winters.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, all the time. It's just windy now.
Ah, okay. Okay, yeah, I've always heard about England, you know. Half an inch of snow, and man, what are we going to do? We're stuck here for the weekend. Okay.
We are slightly...
That's not always a bad thing.
Right. Yeah, I wish.
Yeah, we are slightly better at handling the snow in Scotland. Only slightly.
Only slightly.
Yeah, it takes an inch for us.
1 inch, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so what do we think about Tin Man? I like this episode. I think it's good. I think Tam Elbron was a little overacting, a little bit, some of those headaches. It's almost like he was looking off camera to the director, you know, is this enough? Do you want more pain? Is this enough pain? Should I go a little deeper? Oh, anyway, so, but it was a good premise. You could feel what he was going through, and the relief at the end was pretty nice. Chris, what about you? What's your initial thoughts?
I really like this episode. It's one of these sort of mystery episodes that they never really solve. And sometimes I don't like that, but I think they do it so well in this episode that I'm really happy about it. And I think Tammy Aldrin's a fantastic character. It's an interesting concept to have a Betazoid that isn't quite the same as the rest.
Mm-hmm. Right. Colin, how about you?
I love it. I think it's a brilliant episode. The other week, was actually having a Twitter chat about this episode when I scared the bejeebus out of James because he thought he was doing 3 episodes. and we had a really good conversation. I had a lot of people feeding back to me on Twitter when they realised I was doing this episode. So it's a very popular episode. One particular person who's Mr. Picard on Twitter, that's Mr._Picard. He said that he completely relates to Tam in this episode, and he thinks it's wonderful how they heal each other.
Yeah, right. I'm surprised that nobody foresaw Tam deciding to stay. You know, I'll be his bridge back, his reminder to his obligation to us. I think even the first time watching that, we knew what was going to happen. He was not coming back. But anyway, Doc, what about you?
Now, I feel really bad because I think I'm just going to spoil a nice party because I'm not actually that keen on this episode. And, I mean, also, I kind of question about what's the end game in this episode? I know that it's not quite played, that you know what goes on, but I kind of was watching this and I kind of got the impression that it was like a mutual suicide pact at the end, rather than those two people reinforce and they find each other. So I was less enthusiastic on this one than I have been on other occasions.
No, they didn't die at the end.
We don't know that, right?
They never conclusively say either way, but the impression you're given is that they've gone somewhere else rather than dying. So I'm quite happy to leave it like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he says we all now, you know, we now help each other.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
I presume that meant that, you know, we'll go off and do our things together. He actually says in the episode that Gontu is from probably outside the galaxy, so.
Okay.
Actually, I'm always deeply suspicious when they claim that something's from outside the galaxy. By the way, it's stuff that comes up in TOS and some early TNG where they want to make something sound like more mysterious than it otherwise would be, and they will reference things from outside the galaxy, and then you pretty much see that disappear as you are as you get into latter TNG, DS9, Voyager, and stuff. It's very unlikely to. I don't know if Voyager ever stumbled across anything from outside of the galaxy. Anyway, that's just an aside.
No. TOS did it a lot.
Yeah, it did.
Wait a minute.
The Kelvins.
You said you're not sure if... I was kind of perusing my notes. You said you're not sure if Voyager came across anything from outside the galaxy?
Yeah, you're going to tell me the caretakers from outside.
Species 8472.
Well, okay, hang on, that's different.
That's a different dimension.
They live in the galaxy, but they're just in a different, you know, like, I always consider them to be the equivalent of, you know, in that garden you have a mole that lives on the ground. They kind of live in the galaxy, but in this kind of subspace fluid land.
Ah, okay.
I always took Species 8472 as being interdimensional.
Fluidic space.
Or whatever that means.
Yeah.
So what's the opposite of fluidic space? Deserted space?
Deserted space, yeah.
Okay. All right. So the hood. We're in the hood.
We saw the hood about 3 weeks ago, I think. Mm-hmm. Right? Wasn't it with Allegiance when they were going to meet the hood?
Yeah, but they never made it.
And Picard, they never made it because Picard went crazy.
Right. Took him this long.
I think the only other time we saw the hood was Encounter at Farpoint.
It wasn't. I think we saw it. I thought we also saw it again in season one, but we certainly did see it in the Encounter at
Farpoint. Oh, yeah.
But I did mention recently that the hood sounded familiar for some reason. And this is why. The hood's warping to the Enterprise because they have a passenger named Tam Elbron. And it's very clear. This is another one of those. Everybody knows this guy, but we don't. We know anything about him, but all we know is that the same Tam Elbron of the Garushta disaster. It's kind of like Ensign Roe. It's another time they use this troop of Ensign. Not that Ensign Roe. Can't be the same one. So they're setting us up to where he's got to be a terrible, terrible person.
Funnily enough, it was the same character on the Enterprise. It was a little bit short with them as well. I mean, in both Tam Elbron's case and Roe Laren's case, it was Riker that was the one that was, I can't believe this person's coming on board.
Yeah.
I've got no time for them. I'm not going to deal with them. I'll deal with them as much as I can get away with and then ignore them the rest of the time. So Riker's actually a bit off in this episode for that reason.
Yeah, I think it's because always, you know, if they do come aboard, he probably has to do the paperwork and then do their performance review at the end of the year.
But it's also interesting when you take Riker's history that we learn later, the way that he is with Tam and with Ro, because of what he did with the Pegasus incident.
Yeah. Well, I think in this instance, at least they explain it a bit better later on, because Riker admits that a couple of his friends were involved. And I think, did he actually say that a couple of them were killed?
Colin, that is excellent, Colin. I never thought of that, but really, Riker's in the same boat as both of them because of the Pegasus incident. People should be hating him for that. But nobody knows about it. They kept it a secret.
Yeah, Section 31 cover-up.
Yeah, well, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, but as far as Ro, I mean, he expected the highest amount of performance from her, which he expects from every woman.
Yeah.
You certainly expected a good performance in Conundrum.
Yes! Yes. That's when the real Karen McDuff shows up and...
Yeah.
although in defense of Rose, she does actually shoot him in the head in another episode.
Right.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The next phase, yeah.
Yeah.
The next phase.
Okay, I have a question. Tam is quite a common name in Scotland. And it's a shortened version. It's like Tom, but it's a shortened version of Thomas. But I've never really heard it anywhere else. So is it a common name elsewhere? Or is this something they've popped out for this episode?
I have a sister named Tamra, or we call her Tammy. But it's Tam, unless it's Tamara.
Yeah, they're kind of the female names, which is...
No, I'm thinking for a man, how could he possibly have been called Tam? Unless it's Tamara. Tamara.
Well, he's not from Earth.
No,
so.
Betazoid.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, Tam. So why is Tam so popular in Scotland? For women or men?
I don't know. No, man, it's Tam is the same as Tom, so it's a shortened version of Thomas.
Oh. Maybe Betazoid was colonised by the Scots.
It's certainly got to be better than Sub Rosa.
Yeah. What? I mean, why do we call our Richards Dick?
Well, I do know a few
I know
dicks.
Quite a few dicks. Doesn't yeah. matter what their names are. They're dicks.
No, they're just dicks. Yeah.
But still, where does that come from? Richard, Rick, Dick? I don't know. Okay, so Tam beams...
I don't know. When you get Bill from Will, right. from William, people call him Bill.
Yes, she does. Bill.
So how'd you get Bill from William?
Okay. Or Jim from James.
Yeah, where does I come from?
Oh, by the way, he doesn't like to go by Jim. Can you believe that? A guy...
Oh, I found that out in Pathfinder.
A guy doing a Star Trek podcast by the name of James does not like to be called Jim. Of all the things I could have been doing all these years.
So you're missing a soundbite there, because you could put the soundbite in a Kirk saying, call
damn it,
Jim.
Jim. Oh, no, me doing it. Damn it, Jim. Damn it, James. That doesn't work. It does not work. So he's pretty much screwed me out of that.
Well, hang on. The real crime here is that we have a listener who recently had a child who he christened James and chose not to christen him James Tiberius. I think that's the real neglect that's going on from a so-called Star Trek fan.
Sure. Yeah. Well, what about the fact that I actually tried to figure out how old I would have to be for first contact, and I feel like I've been cheated out of maybe about 5 or 10 years. Tops. But
no, I've walked it that way.
But
is it 67?
63. Yeah, April 5th, isn't it? Yes. April 5th, 2063.
I'll be 83.
Yeah, there's no way I'm gonna live that long. But then I was glad that my daughter would be around for first contact. And then I started to think, yes, but if I believe in reincarnation, then for me to be an adult, maybe a scientist for first contact, that means I've got to die in the next few years, like 10 or so years, so that I can be 18 during first contact.
You might not be dead, Lou. The way medical science is moving at the moment.
You haven't seen me lately. There are people half my size having heart attacks. I'm just borrowing time right now, apparently.
So, Colin, you should consider that I need an option on the next 4 seasons of the Battle Bridge, just in case anything happens.
Yeah, just... Well, you've got my email, James. sure. Just drop me one and it's on there.
Wait a minute. No, according to Chris, it's going to be him. Carnivore J. No, Carnivore.
Oh,
he thinks
okay,
he's in line for the throne. We have him on so much. And he wanted to hijack this call. So, anyway.
Chris is always welcome.
Absolutely. Nice guy. Absolutely. Okay. So, Tam Elbron beams aboard, finishes everyone's sentences, but then is freaked the hell out when Data says, hello. Who? What are you?
Don't you think that's a level of control, though, that he finishes everyone's sentences and no one has a go at him for it?
Has a what?
No one has a go at him for his abrupt and rude nature.
Well, they just put up with it.
You know, and aren't telepaths supposed to not read your thoughts?
Well, here's another question. When he was standing on the transporter pad, didn't he, like, see three people in the room? Or, does he not even use his eyes? He just uses... telepathy. How could he not know Data was there?
I think he uses a telepathy more than anything else because it's always on. So.
All right.
Yeah, and he does actually sign a letter saying that he can hear every voice on the ship. So when you've got that much information coming in, it's easy to miss someone that's not.
That's true.
In your head.
That is true. But what I didn't get was, can you imagine... Even for a telepath who's used to reading minds, like she says, he had his telepathic power switched on at birth. Wow. That's got to be, just like being born in the Borg.
Actually, let me just point out, I think this is a really great thing that they develop with the Betazoids in this episode, the fact that they're not born telepathic. that kind of makes sense, right? There's a certain amount of probably maturity that you'd want to have from a species perspective before you start to be able to read people's minds. And then the fact that there are some people that are born with it turned on and how that would completely screw them up. To me, actually, I quite like this backstory they were putting onto the beta sets, and to me, it made a lot of sense.
So yeah, I like the way they tied into
puberty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you're born, take another sense, take hearing, you're born with your hearing switched on. So wouldn't it just be like sitting in a crowded room the entire time? You would learn very quickly to tune it out.
Yeah, that'll marriage. Mm. You learn to tune voices out when you're married because, you know, otherwise she doesn't show.
I'm sorry, what'd you say, Colin?
But you're studying.
Oh, sorry, I was,
never mind. You know.
And anyone who's a parent learns to tune out noises.
Oh,
as
no
well.
Kidding. No kidding.
The real trick with being a parent is learning to tune out noises while also remembering not to tune out at at specific times. Because the scariest noises a parent is utter silence.
Yes, because then you wonder, hang on, what are they doing?
Yep.
That is true. Oh, you're too quiet.
With the baby having kind of, you know, recently been born over summer, the number of times where you wake up in the middle of the night absolutely terrified that there's no screaming going on, and you do literally wander over to the baby and go, I wonder if they're dead yet. And you can like prod them and go, oh no, they're still breathing. And then you go back to sleep. And this happens at 3 o'clock in the morning. And it's really weird. You have this sense that you haven't heard stuff, which is quite weird.
Well,
there was a number of times I did something similar. You'd walk into the room and hold your phone to see if the chest was rising up and down.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, still breathing. That's fine.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, I did one better than you all. I bet you none of you, anyone who has children on this call, I bet you none of you put a camera right above the crib. I mean.
No, I've still got that.
Really?
It's almost two. I've still got a camera on.
Oh, I had a camera in my daughter's room till she, I think it was about 7 or 8 that my wife said, okay, it's starting to get a little weird now. You probably should take that out. I'm like, well, I want to know if she's actually sleeping. She's got to be in bed asleep. But no, and I even went one step further, especially, you know, for my mother. I actually put it on the web so that she could go to the web address. Log in. You had to have a username and password. Thank you. But she could log in and watch her too. She would sit there and watch. My mother would watch the baby in the crib. She loved it.
But grandparents is a different situation again. Grandparents dote over them.
Definitely. But yeah, I liked having that camera in the room. And I could, you know, it was real time live. I could actually see her chest rising and falling. And I made sure she didn't accidentally roll over. Or, you know, she's still on her back. But yeah, when you're a parent, my God. Okay, so anyway.
Tin Man.
Huh?
Star Trek? Anyone?
Oh, Tin Man? Yes, Tin Man.
Yeah.
So let's see. That's a little backstory. He was on a first contact mission to Garushta, in which, get this, yep. Not 46, not 48, ta-ta, 47 people were killed. So, but they blamed the captain because he made some kind of mistake that sparked the conflict. Do you guys agree with Riker? But if Elbron was so good, what was he doing there if he couldn't read all that hostility?
No, because you can't cover for every single eventuality. There's got to be mitigating circumstances, and I think that this might fall into that.
Right.
Yeah, and we also get an explanation from Tam later about why it went wrong.
Yeah.
So, and when you get that explanation, then yeah, it's like Chris said, you can't. There's always going to be variables in any given situation.
Right. And he says he tried to warn Darson.
Yeah.
Doc.
No, sorry, I was going to say the most believable part of that is that Darson wasn't going to listen to Tam. You can see why, because Tam does rub people up the wrong way.
Yeah. Doc?
Oh, I was just about to say that, you know, when you're making the assumption of why they feel the hostility, you're kind of assuming that all races are the same and they would behave in the same way. But would you really expect hostility from a lion just before a lion attacks you? I mean, would you be reading the brain waves in the same way? You know, to a certain extent, there might be things that are just more of a norm for the kind of creatures, the kind of aliens you're dealing with. So it's not as if, you know, I'm sure you could probably read, if you have to go from a, you know, from pacifist tendencies to kind of like full fury, you could probably read that. But if it's, if they are more volatile races or just a different type of thinking, to me, it seemed like an unfair criticism.
Well, yeah. When you could equate that to like the Klingons or the Nausicaans, mm-hmm. who are very belligerent, but they don't automatically attack.
I do like the one species that Enterprise comes into that, you know, putting them down and being belligerent to them is normal, you know.
So you're talking about the Tellarites,
is that what
right?
they? I don't know what they're called, but was
the pig people that are rude.
Yeah, as soon as they beam on board, man, this stinks in here. It must be you. Hello to you too.
The Tellarites.
Yeah, well, isn't the Tellarites arguing a national pastime?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The pig people. That's right. The pig people. They do look like. Yeah.
That's supposed to be from pigs. That's supposed to be evolved pigs.
Hmm. Okay.
Because they're in Joan of Babel in the original series.
Mm.
In a relatively ropey makeup. Mm. But it was
does
great.
That mean, does that mean that at a banquet you wouldn't serve any pork?
I think it would be. Yeah, I think it would be rude.
Yeah,
I mean, as rude as serving monkey, I suppose.
So if you hear, Captain, this is some terrific food. Oh, crap, he hates us. Okay. All right, so, conference. Data lays out the plan. They're here to observe this planet that's about to go supernova. And as soon as it does, oh, Data, shut the hell up. Let's get to the real reason why we're here.
Starlu.
I love that part. You know, he's just like, oh, good God, stop. Oh, God. I mean, you could tell Tam was just completely getting more pissed off by the second about every second that's going by and we're not getting to our real mission. Tin Man, who, oddly enough, has absolutely no tin on him or in him.
I wondered about the name Tin Man because...
Oh, I know exactly.
My reference for Tin Man would be Wizard of Oz.
It's got to be where they get it from.
But I don't see how that Tin Man relates to this Tin Man, because that Tin Man was famous for wanting...
Mm.
Was it a brain? A heart?
No, heart.
It was a heart, yeah. But I don't see how that relates to this one, because it's just...
What?
It's just a complete unknown.
They were on the Yellow Brick Road. No, then that would have made him the wizard.
The only thing I can surmise from the Tin Man reference is the fact that Gontu had lost his heart.
Yeah, could be. But they didn't know anything about him. It's just this creature that showed up here and showed up on their long-range scans. So they're going to try and make first contact with him. But then again, what about the Romulans? Where are they? Are they in Federation space? Are they in the neutral zone? Are they in Romulan space? Where was this?
Well, from what he says when he says we don't recognize Romulan's claim on this space, I would say it's unclaimed space by anyone.
Okay. But, I mean, don't the Romulans have to cross the neutral zone to get there?
Depends on where it is. Mm.
Okay.
I mean, the neutral zone is a buffer between Federation and Romulan space, not across the entire galaxy.
That's a good point. That makes sense. Okay, yeah, but anyway, Tam is coming out of his skin about the amount of time Data's wasting, and then he just completely cuts him off and talks about Tin Man. Make contact with the creature before the Romulans can get to him. Do you think let's say, you know, Picard just stopped because, as we know, the Romulans passed him by, took a couple pot shots and went on. Let's say Picard just stopped. What are the odds that Tin Man will convert to Romulanism.
He's got no intention of that because he's waiting for Tam.
Yeah. But nobody knows that, obviously. They just believe that...
Apart from Tam, yeah.
You know, the Federation doesn't want Tin Man taking Romulan side.
But see, the thing with the Romulan encounter, which I didn't get, which is, yeah, I know it's a plot device, yeah. But the Romulans pass over him, they fired a few shots at him, knocks the shields down to 78%, and it takes them ages to get the 22% back.
Yeah.
You know, but in other times, you know, they're fighting the Borg and the Borg's pounding away at the ship and the shields are fine.
Right. Well, how in the hell did Enterprise last 4 years?
Yeah.
I mean, polarize the whole plating. We're talking about Klingons that had shields and, you know, polarize the whole plating and we may have a shot. No, you don't. No, you shouldn't have a shot. But anyway, it's pointless. But then the Romulan, we find out that they've actually destroyed their propulsion just to get there, just to make first contact. They completely destroyed their way of getting back to Romulan space. So what was their plan? I mean, the second one, meet up with them in a couple of days, beam everyone aboard, destroy the ship.
Probably.
Tractor beam Tin Man back to Romulan space. Oh, that's right. If he doesn't come with them willingly, they get to destroy him. And this is the arrogance of the Romulan. The first Romulan ship got vaporized in a fraction of a second. The second one wants to claim right of vengeance. Yeah, you go for it.
Which seemed very Klingon to me.
Yeah.
I don't like the Romulans in this episode. And I think the presence of the Romulans make it a poorer episode. I don't think there's any real logical threat that Tin Man's going to convert to, you know, Romulanism and go off and be theirs. I don't think that the Romulans per se would be after this kind of encounter with, you know, frankly, it's like, you know, two people are sitting on opposite sides of an ocean and they see a big whale and they both head out with warships to get the whale first in order to say hello. I just didn't buy it. And then, in particular, I think once the first Romulan ship is destroyed, and everyone likes to see the big explosion, right? And everyone likes to see the big, you know, warbirds. But the idea that then the Romulans turn into this idea that, oh, we're going to have right of vengeance against this whale that happened to destroy one of our ships, they just kind of turn into comedic, kind of villains of the week. And I think the Romulans are above this kind of the performance that they have given in this episode.
Yeah,
well,
the problem with the Romulans.
They were almost Ferengi-like.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other problem with the Romulans and all in this is we know that the other ship is 2 days behind. So that means the Enterprise sat, waited, trying to fix their repairs for 2 days because the other Romulan ships showed up. And also, if the Romulans are close. Yeah, and also they picked up the Romulan vessel on long-range sensors. Wasn't it cloaked? Because it decloaks as it comes in by the Enterprise. So how did they pick it up on long-range sensors?
Good point.
Is this the first ship or the second ship?
The second ship.
The second ship. Because the first one, they're supposed to be pushing their engines so hard.
Yeah, the first one they pick up because...
Kind of.
Yeah, they're out of phase because their engines are 30% maxed out. But the second one, when they get the sensors back online, Worf picks up the other Romulan ship on long-range sensors. Yet when it arrives by the Enterprise, it decloaks. So how did they pick up a Romulan warbird?
Maybe they just forgot to cloak as they're getting into the center. So they get picked up and then they go into cloak and it's like, damn
too late.
You said it was like 4 mile radius, not a 3.5 mile.
So someone, you obviously believe that there was no need for the Romulans in this. We could have done without them.
Yeah, that's
right. I don't think so. I think you're wrong because of the setup, the way that they started with what he did on Garushta, then. You know, we can't teach him his lesson because he's going to do it again. We have to give us some amount of danger that he should have told us about, or Picard would never have been. This is why you didn't tell us about this, and an encounter with the Romulans is hardly trivial. Yes, yes, I know, I should have said something. There wouldn't have been that if the Romulans hadn't been there.
I think James's point, Lou, is the Romulans wouldn't behave like this.
No.
They are very one-dimensional in this episode.
Yeah, so what I think, I mean, I hadn't considered the kind of the learning of Tam and how they're trying to reflect the, you know, his previous experience plus what is going on in this episode. And that's, you know, that's decent enough, and I think that's a valid point. But it doesn't have to be Romulans. It could be, you know, villain of the week.
Right.
And everything else would be pretty much the same. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you can get back to the Romulans that much and keep them kind of interesting.
So who else? Go ahead.
I'm not entirely convinced it would be an alien of the week. I think it would need to be one of the major powers in the quadrant.
Yeah.
The wider behind is more Klingon.
Yeah, that I mean that's just the funny thing about it is, I mean, it's a scientific discovery, so from that perspective you would probably go with the Romulans instead of the Klingons, but then the way they act is somewhat Klingon.
So what do you think of Tam and Riker slugging it out on each other during the conference, but not even having to raise fists? It was all in Riker's mind and Tam's mouth. I mean, that was pretty awesome. And no, Billy boy, I wasn't distracted on Garushta. No? Well, I don't care if you believe me. And all the whole time, Riker's looking like, I didn't say a word.
Tam had an argument with Riker's
right.
Brain.
Yes. Number one, you shouldn't have thought that. Why? Can't stop from thinking. I imagine since Riker was pissed off to begin with, he had some pretty negative thoughts that Tam was picking up. So how come Tam didn't try using his telepathy, you know, his Betazoid powers to win over Troy? Oh, that's right. She was his counselor at one time. Which, by the way, was she giving out some secrets? You know, he was my patient. Is she supposed to be revealing that at all?
I don't think it's a problem revealing that someone's a patient. I think maybe going into the details is a bit of a problem with doctor-patient confidentiality. But I don't think actually saying this person was my patient is going too far.
But she does get into details, doesn't she?
Well, it's not as if she sits down and goes, oh, this guy's my patient. He had some horrific, kind of like weird, perverted sexual feelings. Now let me go with them.
Yeah, you must be thinking of Riker. Okay.
The only reason I could think of her revealing what she reveals is it's in the interest of the safety of the ship that she reveals it.
Yeah.
Because she does know certain aspects of his personality, and that could impact the mission they're going on.
That could be. Because obviously she's the one that discovers or figures out that he's in communication with Tin Man. She's got to report that.
Well, the other aspect is that she's not actually his counselor anymore. This was from the past, so I know that she wouldn't be able to bring up too much from the detail of the past, but certainly now anything she would learn would be for the ship. The mission rather than part of his ongoing treatment. The impression we get is that whatever treatment he had as a patient is now either ongoing or he's no longer a patient because he can get out and about and actually work for Starfleet or the Federation.
Sure. What do you think of the interaction between Tam and Data? That actually seemed fun to me.
Yeah, he was obviously very comfortable with Data because of the fact he couldn't read what Data was thinking, although he does say that he can figure him out pretty quickly, which is good. I suppose it was a break from the norm for him.
It was a bit like comic relief and all when he was in Data's quarters and he said, it's a bit Spartan.
Yeah, you know, he reveals the painting.
I thought that was really funny. Yeah.
You never know what Data...
Oh, that reminds me of the painting. Did you think the painting was... the wormhole from
Times Square.
Yeah.
Yes, I thought it was. But what if he had painted something bad? you know, like Troy naked or something. That's why it's covered, because nobody's supposed to see it. Whoa!
I thought you said bad.
Bad. Yeah, well.
Yeah, I was going to say, what's bad about Troy being
nothing
naked?
At all, but he shouldn't have had it. You know, I mean, just like Barkley here.
Well, that's coming up soon.
No, see, now if he'd have painted Barkley naked, that would have been bad.
Oh.
Or Picard.
Wasn't there an episode recently that had a life model that Picard was painting? And
that was the Chris was on for that. That was Deja Q.
Ah. Hmm. And don't forget the Doctor painted Seven naked.
Yes. Yes. And then matter of perspective. The unknown crewman who was, you know, Picard was painting naked.
Yeah, again, it was a matter of perspective, not Deja Q.
Okay. Which Chris was on for both, by the way.
Yeah, that's why I got confused.
Yeah.
It was all in the name of art.
Ancient One Beak, that's what I called him. I was trying to remember what I referred to her in the forum. Ancient One Beak, because it was a song by the Bare Naked Ladies, and she was only in episode One Beak.
All right, so Danger, Gum 2, do not allow. They see, like I said, you have to have the Romulans there because, you know, Tin Man does a spin and all of a sudden destroys a Romulan ship and almost destroys, got the front part of the Enterprise, almost destroyed them.
Yeah, well, that gives them the excuse to be fixing the Enterprise for 2 days. So.
Yeah.
So that's good.
It was already fixing it. It was just slow his 22% back on the shields in Starfleet history.
Well, it's like 93% engine efficiency.
Yeah. And Georgie LaForge was his usual brilliant man management self, barking at people in engineering.
In other words, he was a dick.
Yeah. Well, Geordi normally is.
So, Tam can sense that Gum 2 wants to die. He's here. He knows the star will go Nova, and he wants to die. So his job is to save Gum 2. The Enterprise's job is to make contact with Gum 2. The Romulan's job is to destroy Gum 2. And the star's job is to destroy everyone.
There was one thing that Troy asked about... Tam being in contact with Gum 2 so far away, and it was that kind of, it was almost telepathy over subspace kind of thing, and she was confused as to how that was possible. And I don't know if this is because of the special effect that's used every time Gum 2 protects, but my mind went to the motion picture, because it's the same special effect that they use with V'ger as it is with Tin Man. But the other aspect of that was the fact that Spock was able to pick up that the V'ger's consciousness from so far away. And that was almost a sort of telepathy over subspace kind of thing as well. It's the only other instance that I can think of.
It was actually
where someone
the
was
same special effect, John.
Yes.
No, Spock was able to feel the Vulcans on the Intrepid, I think it was, in Immunity Syndrome.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So from a very long away. But if you think, well, I mean, I think if you think too hard about telepathy, it's, you're probably not going to get anywhere, but is there really why would there be a huge difference between sensing over the vacuum of space if it's like, you know, 1 light year versus 10? I mean, it's not as if it's like it probably takes longer to get there because you're further away, but in terms of there's nothing preventing it, right? It's still vacuum.
What does he say? He's not in communication with it, he's just getting impressions.
Yeah.
But how would it know his name? That's a pretty detailed bit of information, though. He calls himself Gum 2. He's been floating in space. His crew is dead. The closer they get, the better the connection, the radio signal is.
I kind of got the impression that this kind of, you know, I've referred to the Gum 2 as kind of a whale so far, but I almost assume he's like a space whale sitting there, and he probably has a bit of a whale song over telepathy, which is pretty much some type of moody, depressing, folk song, you know, I'm coming here to die, I've lost my people. And then
emo just, will.
emo whale noise. That's how I kind of.
So do you think Gumtree likes country and western music then?
Probably.
Lost my ship, and I lost my crew, and I lost my wife.
My name's Gumtree.
And I want to lose my life. No, but okay, what about Troy, though? When they eventually get there, why doesn't she sense all of this?
She's empathic, not telepathic.
This week.
Yeah. Half beat is right. That's the problem, as usual.
Yeah.
Okay. And of course, if...
Yeah, Troy's only telepathic.
It's great how we can just...
Go on, James.
So it's great how we can just dismiss it like that each and every time. Each and every time Troy is poorly written and they've not really thought about the episode well enough, we go, well, she's only half paid aside. And we have to do this thinking for the writers.
Well, what if they send Luoxana instead of Tam? He would have probably driven himself right into the star instead of waiting for the star to explode.
Yeah, by the time she's done her titles list, he'll say, yeah, screw this, I'm off.
And that's a good question I just thought of right now. I just thought of something. Why is Tin Man circling the star waiting for it to explode? Why doesn't he just make a course for it and go right into the thing?
Maybe it's the blast wave.
I guess a blast wave would be less painful than the closer you get, the hotter it gets.
Well, maybe there's some program that stops him actually flying into the sun, but nothing stops him actually sitting there waiting for it to happen. Mm.
Yeah, I think it's fine, right? I think it's very hard to kind of, you know, cure yourself or cure yourself through starvation, right? But it's when people choose to cure themselves, it's not going to be something that's going to take a gradual amount of time, right? And you have to push yourself in one direction. It's more of a short, sharp decision make, and then you're out of control. So I kind of felt that that's what he was doing. So I would think it's hard for him to run into the sun, but to wait there to be engulfed whilst he's, you know, singing his country stuff, it's fine.
Okay.
Waiting for the train to come.
So Tam wants to go on board and make physical contact and try and get Tin Man away, but Picard's like, no way, Jose. Ain't gonna happen. Until Data talks him into it. Sir, I'll go with him. I'll bring him back. No, you won't. I knew he wasn't bringing him back from the start.
I think it's not just Data talking into him. Picard's hand does get kind of forced as well by the Romulans.
Yeah. Right.
But you did know that Tam wasn't going to come
back. Oh, of course.
Oh.
Yeah. Especially when he goes aboard and all the voices are silent. Do you think that was Gumtree putting up some kind of shield or something to stop all the other voices that he probably still should have heard from the Enterprise? They're right next to him.
Yeah.
Oh, they're silent. But then again, let's put ourselves in Tam's life for a bit. All 35 years, it's been voices in his head. He's been institutionalized. It's driven him crazy to where he tries to keep away from people, all people. Now he's aboard this Tin Man, and there's nothing. All the voices are silent except for Tin Man's. Do you think that would ever eventually drive him crazy, where he needs other contact?
Maybe the previous 35 years are just, they've been hard, so that to finally be able to turn out all those voices is a really good thing for him.
So what do you think he does all day? Let's say he's still with Gumtree and they're still together. What does he do all day, every day? Systems checks? Make sure the engines are okay? Or do you think it's just one massive holodeck the rest of his life? A Nexus, in other words.
I don't think there's any systems to check because Gumtree is actually a living ship.
Yeah.
So there wouldn't actually be any systems checks or maintenance checks or something like that.
Gumtree managed to get his entire crew killed.
Yeah, so I mean, there is limits to him as a living vessel, but there wouldn't actually be... It's not like there's going to be any conduits or anything to repair and stuff like that.
Right, so what's he do? Spend his days and nights on that
gum tube made rock that he sits on?
More or less. He keeps going to a company.
Yeah, but eventually... Okay. Yeah, so if I'm in the car with my wife, say, going to the moon, after a while, or to Mars, it's going to get pretty boring that I need other kind of input. Sorry, dear, but I need something else besides your voice the entire trip.
I like the sound of your car.
Yeah. I mean, so I'm like, what does he do all day, every day? He's got to do something to keep him occupied.
Well, maybe they explore.
I think the clue is what he says about, was it Chandra 3? Where he said they have glacial mines. Right. You know, I think it's the serenity. You know, like Chris said, he's had 35 years of hundreds of thousands of voices in his head. And he's probably just enjoying the serenity. It's like when you go on holiday. You go on holiday to get away from everything. To relax.
But if you were on holiday nonstop, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, year after year after year, eventually work might be a release. I mean, here's another thing. He's a humanoid. He's got needs. He's got wants. Where does he get them?
Yeah, but we don't know. We don't know Gum 2's previous crew wasn't humanoid.
We don't know who they were at all. But what does Gum 2 do for him when he feels a little frisky someday? Do you think he built something?
If he can mold a chair.
He can mold other things.
Yeah.
Okay, Gum 2. This time, make those things a little bigger that I can hold on to. Nah, okay.
And we've just got an 18 certificate.
The what? We what?
We've just got an 18 certificate.
I don't know.
But yeah, I just assume that they I mean, obviously it's open-ended at the end, but I assume that they went off, they explored the galaxy without the drone of thousands of voices in his head.
A lot of these questions are one of the reasons why I'm veering more towards the opinion that this is just an elaborate suicide pact. Because then you don't have to answer what they're doing afterwards because they burnt up in the supernova.
Well, I don't think they did.
No.
Well, the alternative is then, you know, does Gum 2 Gert warp? Can they go and do things? Does he provide decent, you know, tea making and toilet facilities? I mean, I think a lot of...
The guy can mold a chair, James.
I would think so, yeah.
Yeah, if you can mold a chair, you can mold tea Earl Grey hot.
Yeah.
Sure.
So does Dam have to get wasted every day to have something to do? Is there holodeck facilities?
Did he at least take his collection of, you know, Klingon operas over?
How many times has he been to Ryza since he met up with Tin Man?
That's the thing. He gets into Tin Man and he goes, right, head in Ryza. Yes. We're on our way.
Okay. All right. So anyway, the second Romulan captain, do you think he might have a heavy set of balls? I mean, they've got to be pretty big, but we observed the destruction of our sister ship, so we are going to destroy that thing. And if you get in our way, we're going to destroy you too.
Yeah, I'd be more worried about Gum 2 than the Enterprise.
Definitely.
Picard's answer to that would have been, go ahead. We'll be over here dodging the next wave that comes from that.
We're at the blast range. We carry on.
Yeah.
Well, right. Now, here's a bit of English. Maybe when... I think it was obviously Worf that says the Romulan has uncloaked. And I have to ask, is that proper English? Isn't it decloaked, not uncloaked? Or does that matter?
Yeah, but he's Klingon.
Well, he's a Klingon, yeah, so it's uncloaked.
He's a Klingon.
Ah, I see. The universal translator screwed up.
Yeah. And also, I think it's impressive that two Romulan ships came in by the Enterprise, and Worf didn't try to shoot at either one of them.
Oh, no, yeah. That's policy. When people are shooting
at him... Worf wants to blow stuff out the sky.
Well, of course, but he has to wait till he's told to. But it's...
Well, he normally gets told no.
Right. Because it's policy. When somebody is trying to kill you, you must stop, evaluate the situation, and then take a distinct approach to the situation. Meanwhile, the bulkheads are coming down. People are dying. But
Oh, well, that explains Best of Both Worlds then, with the Borgs hammering away at the Enterprise and Picard doesn't do anything.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is he valuable?
Well, that explains everything. I mean, even the Dominion War. They wait, they hold off to fire back. The Federation always waits to hold off. They hold off to fire back. Not only that, the Federation's phasers are always on stun when their enemies are always on kill.
Yeah. Deanna's an empath, one week and a telepath next. Yeah.
Yeah. So how many times has Deanna screwed up? But yet,
well, she's crashed the ship twice.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
Once was under orders, though.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So anyway, yeah, I was telling about the Romulan captain. I mean, they want right of vengeance, but they observed the destruction of their sister ship when Gumtu took a quick spin around, and all of a sudden their sister ship, you know, became pieces and parts. I don't even think there were any dead bodies in the flotsam, but... So they're going to try. Do you think Gumtu could be destroyed? Well, obviously he could if the star went nova, but could the Romulans have destroyed him?
I don't think the Romulans could have destroyed him, but obviously he can be destroyed because he is actually the last of his kind.
Ah. And it makes you wonder why that is, too.
Yeah.
Well, even that wasn't exactly conclusive in this episode, because all they said was Gumtu hadn't seen another of its kind for millennia, I think it was. Was the kind of time scale we're talking about. Maybe Gumtu just wandered off so far.
All the others are in the other galaxy.
Yeah.
Mm. Just like a puppy who's walked out of the yard.
So does that mean then that Gumtu's navigation system is crap?
Well, his navigation's crap. His shields are crap. I mean, what was happening when his entire crew was being destroyed by radiation? He couldn't have, like, got out of the way?
No, so he can't get out of the way of danger. His navigation's crap. His shields are crap. Yeah, James, I'm with you. They're dead.
Really? But Data got back in time.
Yeah, and Dicey got back after the explosion.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's the thing that proves to me that Gumtu and Tam were alive.
Yeah, I think so. Unless, you know, Data was caught up in some kind of transporter beam that Gumtu was using.
How did Data get back? I mean, what is the explanation? I mean, so Gumtu can also beam people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that
so what?
So he can. Beam, the dude can beam, warp, communicate over subspace,
mm-hmm.
Create chairs and other implements.
Yeah, and he can throw a ship 3.5 billion miles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's amazing what maybe there's nothing he can't.
No, which actually did bring me to a question I did want to ask you, James. If you was 3.8 billion miles from a star,
right,
would you see the explosion at the same time?
Then you wouldn't see the explosion at the same time, regardless of where you were. So you'd have to be standing right next to it. So
here we go.
It's okay. It's significantly far enough for there to be a notable time delay. I can work it out if you want me to, but it sounds big enough that it would be a significant delay.
Yeah, because the light we see from the sun is 4 seconds old, isn't it?
From where? From Earth.
From the sun to Earth.
No,
it's 4 seconds.
8.5 minutes, isn't it?
It's minutes. I thought it was 6 minutes, but it's
6 minutes. So that's 96 million miles. Yeah.
Don't quote me on that either. I don't know.
Yeah, so that's 6 minutes, 96 million miles. That's 3.8 billion away.
Yeah, it's about 5.5 hours, I think.
Yeah, so when they says it's about to blow, they wouldn't have seen the flash.
Okay, Google.
92.96 million miles. Is it
3.8 billion miles?
No, kilometers. Kilometers.
Billion kilometers.
Yeah.
In light
years.
And the first thing that comes up is TNG Tin Man.
Wow.
Here's
something. The sunlight travels the speed of light, which is 186,282 miles per second, or 899,792,458 meters per second. This means the light from the sun takes 8.4 minutes to travel 93 million miles to Earth. So yeah, it's 8.4 minutes old.
And where they are in the Enterprise, in the episode, they are 3.5 light hours away. So they would need to sit there for 3.5 hours before they could flash. See it.
Good point. So they shouldn't have seen it that fast.
They shouldn't have seen it that fast.
Unless it came over hyperspace. Or subspace.
But so then again...
What always does this with light. It's what generations has about a million of these problems.
Yeah, but guys, that's assuming that we're looking out a window at what we're seeing. Obviously, their sensors has... they're able to maximum range. Their cameras, I suppose, goes a little bit further.
Yeah, I suppose, because actually what the Cern of Usun is a collection of sensor regions, isn't it?
Okay, possibly, but in generations, you know, the sky goes dark.
Very fast.
They also shoot the sun in 11 seconds.
Right.
From the planet, an M-class planet.
Oh god, yeah, I forgot about that, yeah.
So in other words, we're 8.4 minutes away from death at any given moment if the sun just burns out.
That's cool. That gives me long enough to grab a beer.
Bear?
Yeah.
Okay. That's fine. Okay, so the voices are silent. He's
not doing anything else in 8.4 minutes.
That's true.
Actually, on a distance issue.
What else can you do?
You've got 8.4 minutes left, James. What would you do?
I am not going to answer that question.
I was going to say, come on, honey, let's hit the sack, but I'd still have time to spare.
I was going to say, in 8.4 minutes, the question isn't, what would you do?
Yeah, that sucks, because you still know it's coming. You still have a couple minutes to see it.
You know it's coming in 8.4 minutes.
Jeez, you've been doing it longer now?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, you know what? Come on, love. We've got 8.4 minutes and we're all going to die. Let's hit the sack. I've got a dike.
I suppose the flaw in this argument is that if the sun exploded now, we wouldn't know for 8.4 minutes.
Right.
Yeah, so it's kind of a mute point, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's true. Unless obviously, NASA is able to see the explosion before our eyes do. And they...
You can't do that because, as part of general relativity... It's not just that the light travels at the speed of light, but information also travels at the speed of light in the highest sense. Obviously, you can make it travel slower by forgetting things, but within relativity, you can't actually send out information faster than the speed of light without breaking causality.
If the sun went now, the first week that NASA would know would be when the Sol Observatory went down.
ISS?
Yeah, but then
first they've actually got a satellite that's monitoring the sun.
Oh. Yeah, but then they would have to, that thing monitoring the sun would then have to get in contact with the dude on Earth.
Yeah, and it would do that at the speed of light.
So and they'll do that at the speed of light.
Basically.
Seconds delay.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that rules out foreplay then.
Yeah, there you go. That's true. Okay, so let me redo that to 5 minutes of foreplay. And...
No, you've only got seconds now, Lou. Only got seconds now.
No, yeah, you've still got 3.4 minutes.
There's probably a significant enough delay between the sun going out and then kind of the matter come in. slow-moving matter kind of wiping out the planet.
Yeah.
Like they do in generations, right? So there'll be a big explosion you'll see, and then you'll see the big shockwave.
Yeah, like unless the shockwave was traveling at the speed of light, yes, it would be a delay between the two.
No, but the shockwave will be massive, so it will not be able to travel at the speed of light.
Yeah, exactly.
And by massive, I mean has mass.
Has mass, yeah.
Have mass. Okay.
And when I say mass, I mean rest mass, not relativistic mass. Anyway.
Okay.
This must be the only podcast that can combine physics and sex.
Absolutely. Like I said, we don't have any scripts. We just go off of what feels good.
Yeah. Us and the Big Bang Theory podcast.
Big Bang would be operative because you've got 4.5 minutes.
God, two Big Bangs.
James raises an interesting point, actually. How fast would a supernova matter travel at? I know our sun can't go supernova.
Well, if you take Star Trek 2009, then the supernova can actually travel across a galaxy.
Yeah, let's sweep that one under a carpet.
No. We have to just pause here for a second because we had a discussion about Star Trek 09 last week.
Oh, yeah.
In this particular issue. Unless we had it at the beginning of this show and I've forgotten. But we had it with Carnival J, right, Louis?
Yes.
Thought so. So we had a tangent on this. I'm getting confused. We do these back-to-back shows and I get confused about which tangent it is which in,
oh, you
is
broke
in
the
which show.
The fourth wall now, James.
Oh, no. Yes, you did. Oh, we've done that many times.
But you... okay, how far behind is the shockwave?
Get your books out, kids, because Dr. Roberts is about to school ya!
The truth of the matter is that there'll be multiple stages, right? So the light will first hit out, but then you are going to have a large amount of... You're probably going to have a large amount of, like, X-rays, right? Projected out.
Oh, yeah. The
radiation was going to hit you afterwards. Then you're going to have some type of relativistic, these fast particles, and not speed of light, but probably up there in terms of half the speed of light at least, that are going to shower down. And then you're going to have like core fragments probably just rolling along in due course. Like, you know, I wouldn't be able to guess, but you don't have a lot of time.
Basically, you're going to die.
Yeah, either way.
Yeah.
But, Colin, you were talking about that fourth wall. Do you realize, I believe it was the first 6 or 8 episodes of this season that we were actually doing the, we did the second show before we did the first show?
Yeah, I don't know.
And how many times, you know, we go into the second show knowing what we've already said about the first show.
Hang on.
Or the other way around.
Let me ask the question. Colin, how did you possibly find that out? I mean, has Lou been leaking secrets? Or the fact that we mentioned it?
Lou's really works to section 31.
Yeah, right. No, it's the way I hint, wink, wink around on the first episode, what we've already talked about on the second episode that doesn't come up till next week. But we already know what we said.
You can actually tell in certain podcasts because you'll say something and you actually say, you'll catch yourself saying something and you go, oh, hang on, no, we did that the other week.
Yeah, no, that's not. That's
the,
next
it's
week.
It's in the reverse order of the broadcast, so you actually think, "Oh, okay, they recorded this one out of sequence." Then.
Yes, it's pretty obvious when we do that.
I think my favorite one was a couple of weeks ago when James said that yesterday's Enterprise was the best one they'd reviewed to date, and then the next week you heard him say exactly the same thing about Offspring, and I know yesterday's Enterprise is the better of the two.
No.
You prefer Offspring?
No. So here goes. This is the I've been trying to keep what my opinion of the quote unquote best Star Trek episode is. And in my mind, the best Star Trek episode, you know, by the time you hit the first good one, in my mind it's Where No One Has Gone Before. And I think that's a great episode. It's one I love, and it's probably quite a nice personal one myself.
James, we've had this conversation before when we did the time travel episode and we told you that we went into the future and you did Meridian.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that trumped it.
That's your favorite one.
Okay. So that one was the best Trek episode we had reviewed until we got to the Defector. So Defector trumps Where No One Has Gone Before. But then Yesterday's Enterprise trumps the Defector and the Offspring trumps Yesterday's Enterprise. Without question. And I'm happy to have that on record.
So where's Meridian?
Meridian is in about 4 years' time, I suppose.
that means that you were able to say those things in the right order, despite the fact they were recorded in the verse.
Yes,
he's a time traveler, yes,
and I had to think about it hard. But I love the Offspring, and I think it's a top great episode. And I like Data a lot, and I just love the show so much. And I do think that Yesterday's Enterprise was a great action show, and it was very kind of, it was good in the way that what they did on that episode. But Offspring for me is just, it's just extra special. And I'm not entirely sure when Offspring gets kicked off the top perch, because I think there's a good argument to be made that Best of Both Worlds Part 1 does so. But I'm not sure. But if it's not Best of Both Worlds Part 1, it might not be anything.
Ooh. Yeah, I think Best of Both Worlds Part 1 was better than 2. They painted themselves in a corner. How are they going to get out?
Absolutely.
But we'll get to that later. Meridian. See, I don't know a lot of Trek by names, but so I just looked up Meridian, and you're right. I love that episode, too.
No, hang on. One second. Colin's bringing this up because it's a really bad episode.
Oh, I like Meridian. I think it's because it's so sad. It's so sad the way she gets ripped away. What about the episode where...
Am I alone in not liking Jadzia Dax?
I like some of Jadzia. There are some I like more than others.
I mean, to be honest, James, I know a few people who cannot stand Jadzia Dax.
No, I can stand her perfectly fine, but I thought Dax...
No, seriously, Dax, I know people who cannot stand her character.
The Dax character got good when Esri came aboard, in my mind.
No.
I much preferred Esri than Jadzia, and I don't like... I don't know, I Meridian in particular is a pretty poor episode. And this, of course, has a sexy quark head on Nala Visitor's legs, right?
I don't know, geez.
But then again, Tara, I did hear, I don't know if it was on Gamma Quadrant or where, but Tara Farrell did say she took acting lessons during the series.
Yeah, you can tell.
You can tell. Certainly she got better as the first season went on.
Yes, she did get better.
I wouldn't go that far, but you could... You can tell that they had to be during the series and not prior to the series.
What about something, I don't know, where the Defiant comes across this planet that came out of, not came out of nowhere, but it is actually the future of the Defiant crew. They get sent back in time. Children of Time. What do you think of that one?
I actually... don't mind that one. I think that one's okay.
I thought it was great.
I think it's...
That's one I look forward to doing, is Children of Time.
Unfortunately, again, Lou, this is one of the episodes that most people hate.
Really? Okay, so...
I love the way you two are planning for DS9. You haven't even finished TNG yet.
No kidding.
I haven't finished Tin Man yet.
Hey, Blair. note to Blair and Chris. You want me to come on Upper Pylon 2? Put me down for Children of Time.
Children of Time is like end of season 4, isn't it?
Yeah, well, exactly. So we'll see if they actually hear this part.
There was an Enterprise episode as well. It's quite similar to Children of Time.
Anyway, guys, Tin Man, because it's like getting on a bit.
Oh, it is. I'm sorry. That's right. It's only 5 o'clock here. So I got to keep remembering that you guys want to go to bed soon. Okay. So
we're not going to have our 8.5 minutes if we don't get to bed soon.
Yeah, we'll be dead before this episode's done. What about when Tin Man did his slow spin and, the Enterprise started, not when the first spin, it was the second spin, and the Enterprise was being flung however many millions of miles. Did you notice the little dance that Picard and Riker does?
Oh, to show the ship was spinning.
Yeah.
Yeah, that did make me smile. But they were the only ones doing it. Did you notice that as well?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And Riker in particular is just standing there going, woo. And you think, is that really the best shot you got?
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. Woo-wee. So yeah, the star explodes.
The people standing at the consoles at the back of the bridge didn't do it.
They didn't do anything.
No.
Yeah. It's kind of like... Galaxy Quest got it right when they actually put it on a stage that would actually jolt and dart instead of having the camera shake, the entire gimbal shakes. That was awesome. That's what they should have done with Star Trek, really.
Yeah. Galaxy Quest got the rock monster right and all, but there you go.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, so the star explodes and Data magically appears and reports that Tam decided to stay with Tin Man.
Yeah, and there's a touching final scene with him and Deanna.
Yeah.
I love that scene. I think that's the best part of the episode.
Yeah, it was.
The acting
actually tie into the Tin Man, because Data finds his heart belongs on the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. Yeah, that's good.
That just came to me.
Good job. You put the whole episode in perspective. Yeah. This is where Data belongs.
Yeah. So he could actually come in, he's an android, so he's, you know, he could be the team man.
Right. Okay.
It's a brilliant ending to this episode, but it's also quite sad in that the way Data appears on the bridge after the order they see it is that the star explodes, and the first thing is, oh no, we've lost Data. So there's that brief moment where they think Data's gone, and then he appears on the bridge and everything's fine. And that is very, very reminiscent of Nemesis, the movie. In exactly the same way that the scimitar explodes, and then for a few seconds you think, oh no, we've lost Picard and Data. And then they realise Picard's behind them because he's beamed back.
Yeah.
And then they think, okay, no, we have actually lost Data. So for that, it's Troy that seems most affected by the fact that Data's gone. So to have the scene at the end of this episode with Data and Troy linking arms, and there's a really nice character moment, and yet it's kind of sad to know what's going to come.
Oh. Does anyone else feel cheated that we didn't see some resolution to B4?
No, because they did tie it up in the books.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I don't read those, so.
Okay. Data's B4 sacrifices himself, and Data's download overtakes B4's body.
But how does that work? Because B4's circuitry and positronic net is all kind of basic compared to what Data had. This is one of the things that confused me about that ending. I could understand how Data's program would eventually take over, but it would still be within a lesser shell.
Yeah, but if Data's personality and intelligence takes over, then he knows how to enhance himself.
Possibly, but then again, he obviously tried creating offspring with Lal, and it didn't last long.
Well, Geordi somehow helps him.
Maybe I need to read the books.
Yeah, I don't have a clue. I never read any of the books, so. Okay, guys, then if anyone doesn't have anything to bring up, we should go into our thoughts.
No, I'm done.
The only thing that I can think of is, how did they first get onto Gomtu in the first place? Because we know the Enterprise was staying quite far back from the
They had a probe, the star. Like a probe.
So they sort of beamed as a hop on the probe.
How did he get onto Gomtu? Didn't they just beam him there?
They beamed quite a distance. Well, what's the range of the transport?
Yeah, they probably piggybacked on the probe.
Okay. No, I don't remember them saying anything like that. I thought they were just close enough, and then Gomtu just shoots them farther back before the star explodes. I mean, they were right there next to each other, from what it looked to me.
Well, the distance that they can transport is like Troy's telepathy. It varies from episode to episode.
Exactly.
True.
Yes. Yes. You can't beam into the next room, but yet you can beam onto Vulcan from Earth. Depends on when you need it. Okay. I mean, there was a technology that they should have kept, but for some reason they decided to...
Yeah, but that's an alternate universe.
Yes, it is. Right, yes. And how the heck did the Federation ever forget that once, you know, one time we actually ran across these people? It was, the Borg. There was another captain on another Enterprise that came across something just similar to this, but I'd be damned if I remember what it was.
That was just lost in bureaucracy.
Oh, yes.
Honestly, fast forward 200 years from now and most things will not have been remembered.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, nobody knows about the Firefox plague. So
it was only 20 years after the Wrath of Khan, and they tried to put out a film that was basically the Wrath of Khan again, and some people thought it was acceptable to watch. Oh. So who knows what will happen in 200 years.
Yeah, yeah, I was in
Was that a reference to Nemesis or Into Darkness?
Yeah. And they did it, perhaps, and then they did it 10 years later as well.
Right, the Into Darkness one. I was in a crowded movie theater trying to keep my mouth shut. You know, when we have Kirk inside the little door and Spock. No. I severely had to keep my mouth shut. I was like, oh, come on! I was doing that a lot.
So. Yeah, so was I. And I actually quite like Into Darkness, but there's certain aspects of that movie I was going, oh, come on! Exactly the same thing.
Exactly. You know, Spock screaming Khan?
No.
That was,
no.
That's just blasphemous. Blasphemous. So anyway, Doc, let's take us to our thoughts.
Again, it's now time for our final thoughts and ratings on this episode, giving us a number on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. Now I'm going to hand it over to the guests first, because I don't want to bring us down. So
you're going to wait till bring us down?
Well, I think we should go out on the...
Okay.
We'll see. Here's the thing, right? I'm gonna say that I. No, I am gonna go first now. Now I've been baited into this. But I'll just point out that very often we have these discussions. I kind of come in and say, "Well, I didn't think it was that great," and then you come in and say, "No, I thought it was pretty good." We have a chat and we then put our numbers on the table and they're the same number. And you think, "Well, how did that happen?" I don't think this is a great episode of Trek. I think this is. It's perfectly reasonable. I really do consider it to be pretty much middle of the road. I like certain features that they try to bring out in the character of Tam coming on board. I like also a little bit of backstory behind the Beta Z Way. Certainly the Beta Z Way away from the kind of Roxana episodes. I thought that the Romulans were severely miscast in this episode, and I didn't think it really added much to it. I think that there are a lot of questions about what exactly, if this is about, you know, two people having to find themselves in order to fulfill certain things that otherwise, you know, they would feel that is missing. I just think it's not as well executed as it could have been. I don't have a huge amount of love for this show. I come in at 3 out of 5. So just in my opinion, it's just your average episode of Star Trek.
Okay.
So now I'll hand over to our guests.
All right. How about Kieran? Kieran, how about Chris? I'm looking at the list as I'm typing these out, you know, the ratings, and I see Kieran. So, Chris, how about you?
The names are interchangeable. It's fine.
Yeah,
that's fine. I really like this episode. I don't think it's perfect. I don't think it's anywhere near perfect. But I like the concepts. I mean, I like the idea of a space-born creature. I think it feeds into my belief, and there's a bit of scientific backup with the idea that life can breed in just about anywhere it's even physically possible to breed. And I like the idea of a species that's actually born in space itself. Yeah. It won't be the last time we see this either. I know we've got Galaxy's Child coming up next season. But there's a lot of mystery behind Gomtu, or Tin Man, or whatever you want to call him. And I like the fact that they solve very little of it. So the idea that there's not just unknowns in the universe, but there's unknowns that we're not going to learn about for a very long time. I mean, there may be hundreds of years in the future they do come across another of the species. As I said earlier, it's never entirely clear whether this Gomtu is the last of the species or just the Gomtu's gone so far that it's away from any of its own kind because of that. So maybe in another galaxy there's lots of Gomtus running around. But I mean, I would have liked to have known a bit more about the crew that Gomtu was living with, and the kind of the relationship between ship and crew. There might have been an interesting aspect of that, and well, certainly it would have been good to know what would have happened with Gomtu and Tam afterwards.
Yeah,
but I'm very happy to leave all that to imagination and fan fiction and books and all the other kind of areas that might turn up in, because this episode alone, it introduces some nice concepts, makes you think about different things. I even like Tam. I like the idea that not all Betazoids are grow into their telepathic abilities. It's some of them haven't switched on by birth. It's almost a sort of, would they consider this a disability on Betazoid? I don't know. Maybe they would. But yeah, it's there are problems with it. The Romulans are a bit one dimensional. Obviously, the idea that not a lot is solved could frustrate some people when they're watching it. But I like it, and I think I'll give it a good solid, good enjoyable 4 out of 5.
Cool. All right, Colin.
It's nice to see that Chris is summing up as long as his emails.
Oh no, that was much shorter.
Yeah. I think he just about covered everything. I don't know what else to say after that. apart from the music, this is Jay Chataway's first musical on Star Trek, and he went on to do so many other episodes after this. Eventually, he became the main composer for Star Trek. So I think it's good to see Jay Chataway's first footsteps into the Star Trek universe. I also do like the fact that we do get an insight into Betazoid evolution, so to speak. But I think that Romulans would have been better if they were Klingons. Mm. But apart from that, I think Chris has basically said everything else. So, yeah, I'll give these 4 out of 5 as well.
Okay.
I'm really glad you brought up the music. That was one aspect we haven't spoken about. It was fantastically done. The flute music throughout was fantastic. I'm not really surprised that you brought it up, being the host of Melodic Jacks, which is one of my favourite podcasts. Ex-host. Well, yeah. It's on. Is it?
Okay.
Yeah, it's still on iTunes and everything. You can still download Melodic Tracks, yeah.
Maybe one day. Maybe one day it'll come back.
I'll be one day, yeah. Well, yeah. Can't say anything else.
We'll see. Okay. And then I get to play cleanup. I don't think it could have been the Klingons, obviously, because there has to be a little bit of hostility between us and them. It's who's going to get the Tin Man first, and since the Klingons are our allies now, wouldn't have made any sense. So, but we could have done without the Romulans completely. It's all a matter of getting Tin Man away from that star. But then again, had we not had the opposition, then we wouldn't have been able to teach Tam this lesson again, because he puts us all at risk again. I liked the episode a lot. I thought there were some points where Tam was a little bit overplayed, especially in the pain part, but I felt sympathy for him, for his struggles. And when he finally got all those voices silent, I was happy with him. So I think the guy who plays Tam did a very good job at this. It has bits of Ro Laren with another person who's going to be hated based on rumors and speculation. So I'm kind of shocked that in the 24th century we can hate somebody that we don't even know. Riker really plays that pretty badly. He hears things, and two of his friends were killed, so therefore he hates Tam. He doesn't belong there, and he plans to give Ro a hard time. And he eventually does, but sometimes in a good way, I suppose. Other than that, I think it's a very sweet episode, really. I mean, you know, I don't know. I do like it. I don't think it's the most perfect. I don't think it's the worst. I don't even really think it's a middle of the road doc. So I agree with the boys there, and I'm giving this a 4, and that hasn't changed since 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago when I watched it. So I'm not standing alone. I'm giving this guy a 4 as well. So that is that. Okay, so let's see when we have you guys on next. Kieran, I have you. Chris, I have you on for Sarek.
Yeah, looking forward to that.
That's going to be in 3 weeks. And I don't mean 3 weeks. I mean 3 episodes. So that, let's see here. November 28th. It looks like December 19th is where it's at right now.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation, a serious accident releases highly toxic chemicals.
Begin evacuation of secondary hull.
And contamination ignites a chain reaction that's tearing up the Enterprise.
Controls are not responding, sir.
Now the crew faces destruction at breakneck speed.
We can't shut it down, Captain. She's accelerating out of control.
On the next exciting episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
So join us next week as we review episode 21 of season 3. That is going to be Hollow Pursuits. And we will once again have Chris on for that. Not you, Chris. The other Chris. The one that begins with a C, not a K. I've been Lou from Nebraska.
No, I've been Chris and Kieran from Glasgow, Scotland.
Yeah, he's got dual personalities.
I'm Colin from England.
And I'm James from London. Thanking everyone for downloading.
Yeah. And good night. Say good night, Kieran and Colin.
Good night, Kieran and Colin.
That sounds like a bit from the two Ronnies in. It's good night for me and it's good night for him.
Mm-hmm. Good night for us all. And to all a good night. Sorry.
Now it's time to go into our forum feedback. And this week we are going to be reading feedback for yesterday's Enterprise.
Sounds good to me.
And the first couple of people are just me hassling people for feedback. But I think the first proper feedback we get is from Blair, Medic1849 on the forums.
So you don't want me to say anything about the hardcore gangster polka?
No, I don't.
Okay, guys, if you want to know about the hardcore gangster polka, just go to the forum feedback and read it.
I thought we'd just start with Blair.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, it's good show, guys. This episode is an absolute 5-star episode. I remember being totally confused about this episode the first time I saw it. That being said, my confusion was totally overshadowed by how different this episode was and how badass Captain Picard was and the action scenes. A few points. First, Chris must be banished to Lower Pylon 4 for mentioning the naked now. Next, I love the prune juice comment by Worf. Seeing as he isn't in this episode much, he's certainly made an impact. The following point is, as for Worf, I think it would have been cheesy for him to show up as one of the Klingon captains. I think the writers made a good call on this one. Next point. As for all of the coincidences, I'm willing to suspend disbelief and go with what they are showing us. Yes, the alternative universe in DS9 got a little silly, but I loved those episodes. It gave us a chance to see our characters be out of character. Following point is that he liked our observation about Garrett and Castile being the same as Janeway in Paris. And finally, I loved the final battle sequence. For its time, it was really cool, although looking back, it was fairly basic compared to the battle scenes we'll see later in DS9. Mm-hmm. Great show, guys. I love third season TNG.
Yeah, it's where it takes off. You bet. I think we're going to have, you know, I would hazard to guess that we may have more fives in this season than we may have in any other season.
I think so. I would suggest that that's pretty likely.
I got a feeling. Okay, so let's see. This one ends with Kieran McDuff. It doesn't start with Kieran McDuff. It ends with Kieran McDuff because he said, just when we talked to him a few minutes ago, that he was on holiday for a while. So he must have been on holiday for a long while. And he even says, okay, so my catch-up with podcast after my holiday is taking longer than I hoped, but I'm getting there. You guys and you P2 will have time to bear with me. You betcha. Firstly, Chris is absolutely right. The Naked Now is better than this episode. I mean,
that kind of stopped you in your tracks.
What? The Naked Now is better than yesterday's Enterprise? Chris said that? And I let it go? Wow. Okay. The Naked Now is better than... Oh, I'm not going to read that again. Okay, yeah, I said well. The Naked Now is better than this episode. I mean, that's where we first got the sizzle. And how you cannot love the episode purely for that. I don't know. How could you not love that? The sizzle. And we haven't used the sizzle for a while, so... Hopefully we can get some sizzle going. Seriously, though, yesterday's Enterprise is one of the best Trek as a whole, not just TNG. Before we get into it, I'm just stumped because if the Naked Now is better than yesterday's Enterprise, that would make the Naked Now one of the absolute best in Trek, not just TNG. And I got to scrub my brain of that thought real quick because I got to go on. Before we get into it, though, let's cover smaller points first. Prune juice. That stuff is clearly a warrior's drink for the simple reason it declares war on your bowels. Great. Female captains. James is right. The Saratoga's captain in the voyage home is a first female captain. But there's also a female captain in season one episode Conspiracy as well. If I remember rightly, she seemed to take Kirk's record of the youngest ever captain. Captain Trilus Scott of the USS Renegade, according to Memory Alpha. The TKL. Taken Kieran's learning and turned it into food. Wow, that's biblical loaves and fishes stuff. I'm not sure even Jesus could work with this stuff. I'm not sure even Jesus could work with the stuff I come out with. He'd probably poison everyone who ate it. Still, at least it would be plentiful. We solved world hunger, everybody. It tastes like crap, but there's plenty for everyone. Keep churning out those words, Kieran. Is he talking to himself? Or about himself? Or both?
No, so TKL is with the standard ration packs that got referenced in yesterday's Enterprise episode.
Right.
And you try to fit what the TK and L stood for.
To keep living, probably.
Oh, possibly, but you didn't come up with that at the time. You came up with...
I don't remember taking Kieran's learning.
Yeah, no, you did. You wandered onto that.
Really? Ah, okay. I learned something about myself. I didn't know. At least to Kieran with love sounds like a Bond movie. And there's no way Kieran is Sidney Poitier looking good. Good looking. That's a high bar. Okay, before I talk about myself in the third person anymore, let's get into the episode. Scroll down. I love the changeover between universes. It was really done really well done. The special effect is fine for the job. But it's those camera angles that hide Worf and reveal Tasha that really make it. Was it just me that, though the bridge after the change looks a lot like the bridge we got in Generations? It might just be those extra stations on either side, but it definitely looks very similar to me. I'm really glad Worf wasn't in the alternate universe as a bad guy Klingon, as happens in the Mirrored Universe DS9 episodes. My head canon tells me he was likely just killed at Kenimer. I always got the impression these attacks by the Romulans on the Klingon outpost happen at roughly the same time, so it's possible. And now that I've looked up Memory Alpha again, I know Kenimer happened 2 years after the Enterprise C's involvement, so it's very possible Worf was killed rather than rescued by the Federation. I've got to give kudos to Chris for the Nexus retcon, as that always was my thought on it too. In my head canon, there's a part of her that is out of linear time, so she is able to recognize when things change. And they're talking about Guinan, I assume. Yeah. The Time's Arrow retcon is good as well, though. But I think the fact she feels something isn't right rather than actually knowing outright that things aren't right. On James' point about the 22 years that have passed would have taken these people on completely different paths, and it's just a massive leap to think they all ended up on the Enterprise anyway. Well, yes, I would tend to agree, but I still think it's possible. Time to break out the many worlds theory again. It says that anything that can happen does happen to an almost infinite scale. So I would reckon there are many paths where a lot of the same events happen, even if there are a few aspects that change. So I reckon what we have here is reality adjusting as best it can to the Enterprise C change by realigning itself with one of these paths that's relatively close to the original timeline. Hence, the only one we see in the episode is very similar.
Okay.
Otherwise,
let me pause there because...
Please.
I was invited on to our good friends at the Sci-Fi Waffle podcast to talk about parallel universes, I think. And, you know, under that many worlds theory kind of comes up. And we ended up not talking about it because we ended up talking about other stuff at the time and it went long and et cetera, et cetera. But I'm just going to put it out there as a borderline threat that one day I will talk about the many worlds theories and other interpretations of, you know, both cosmology and quantum mechanics. And I'll tell you why I think they're complete nonsense. Because I don't, as a person, I don't buy into Millibot's theory at all. It is something that comes out of a way that you simply choose to model certain things in the quantum world. And I think that a lot of this stuff that comes out, certainly when it gets into the, when it gets into popular media, what they do, they take terms and they take very technical aspects of it and they kind of extrapolate them. So one day we'll get a podcast on that, but not today.
Okay, so you wouldn't believe in the many worlds theory. What about the many dimensions theory? I can see in many dimensions that this path is similar. It's just one of the infinite number of Sheldon Coopers in the infinite dimensions. You know, this one just happens to have them together, but with a slight change, and then some dimensions would have them completely apart.
No, I don't think that's... Why would you assume that happens rather than it not happen? It seems very largely convoluted. And right. One thing that it usually comes out of, a lot of this thinking came out of breakthroughs in quantum mechanics that relied on probability distributions in order to measure certain things and predict certain outcomes of experiments, basically. So in the old classical world, you used to have this concept of, you know, just you knew what things were, you knew how things moved, and you could predict things, you know, ballistics and stuff. And then when you went into the quantum mechanics world, you couldn't do that with you know, like a particle model. So you ended up having to consider particles as effectively probability weighted diffusions of matter, I suppose, is the best way of describing it. And then they were able to reconcile a lot of the modeling to this kind of probability wave particle duality approach. And then what happened is that then some people sat around and thought, well, what does this really mean for reality? And then very quickly people started saying, well, maybe everything exists in these infinite number of states, and it's only, you know, it's only like the observation that crystallizes it, which is kind of known as the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. And then other people said, well, why don't we just assume that everything happens, but you're only following one of the paths? I personally think it's convoluted to put that across. And I've even seen people suggest that it's something kind of provable by science, that this thing happens in multiple dimensions. And it's not provable in a way. It's almost by definition, you can't prove it because there is no evidence and there can be no evidence of this being there. So it's much more of a, you know, if you happen to have the models needed in order to make sense of quantum mechanics, then when you extrapolate those up to the, you know, quote unquote real world, they look just freakish. And then what people try to do is they try to take that freakish outlook and turn it into this kind of many worlds interpretation. But my opinion is simply that the models, you shouldn't be looking at interpreting like that. They are simply a mathematical construct that allow you to get nice results. And I would almost go as far as saying that a model is a model. Don't confuse a model that tries to predict reality with reality.
Okay.
And I'm prepared to do an hour and a half on this one day. Please, someone, you know.
Yeah, take him up on his offer and then, yeah, he'll record it and we'll put it online. Okay, so he goes on to say, otherwise, how would reality choose which path is the right one? As well as this one, there will be many other universes where what James says is correct, and almost none of these people are on the Enterprise, or possibly even born in Wesley's case. I don't know, the idea of reality choosing the right path is a bit of a weird concept to wrap your head around. I'm finding it difficult to put exactly what I mean by this all into words, so I'm treating reality as a conscious being. That's probably how religions begin. So, moving on. The many worlds theory is also why Tasha Yar can exist on the Enterprise C even after the timeline was restored. She's from another universe. As such, she will have different quantum signature from everyone else.
Oh, don't get me started on the quantum signature stuff.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
One of the biggest pile of nonsense that they ever put across with quantum signatures. I mean, it's almost as bad as in Enterprise, they started doing the quantum dating in order to figure out whether or not something was from your timeline or something from the future or the past. And you think, wow. Okay, I'm not going to heckle anymore. I would try to let you finish.
Oh, God. Yeah, I know. I always hated that quantum dating thing, too. Okay, see parallels in Season 7 for that reference. I honestly have no idea if that's actually a thing, and I doubt anyone can prove it. Prove if it was current science. But you need to ask the scientists who know more about many worlds theory than I do. Staying with Tasha, I'm glad they covered her senseless death. I'm sure that was a debate somewhere on the forum as to whether or not it was senseless, actually. But I'm not getting into that again. In this instance, I think it helps to fill reasoning behind her decision to go with the Enterprise-C. And I would have absolutely no problem with that decision. From her perspective, if Guinan is right, everyone else will have a different life, but she will not have a life at all. Going back with the Enterprise-C lets her have a chance. But yet, yes, Lou is right. She could have run into her younger self. You would hope that her Starfleet training and possibly temporal investigations would have prevented that from happening. But given Tasha's difficult upbringing, it wouldn't have been surprised me if she tried to go and rescue herself from that life. I mean, if you knew you could stop yourself from being a victim of rape gangs, wouldn't you do it? That's a really tough one for her. And that is an interesting question, because then all her experiences on the Enterprise would be different, which means different results of just about everything they've done. Fortunately, we know it doesn't arise, though. At this point in time, she just sees it as giving her inevitable death some meaning. Good for her. The decision that Picard grapples with is an interesting one, but I think maybe he grapples with it a little too much. Yes, he may well be getting wiped out if he fixes the timeline, but he's also the one man on the ship that knows he might get wiped out even if he doesn't fix it. He knows how badly the war is going. He knows in 6 months the Federation are expecting to lose it. So to add that Guinan's storyline being just about believable enough makes sense. He must know that at very least the removal of the Enterprise-C from the timeline would change things, even if he doesn't know what. He should know that the Klingons place a huge importance on honor, so the possibility of the sacrifice of the Enterprise-C may fit well into what makes it worthwhile. For me, although it's a leap of faith to believe Guinan, when you weigh the two options, I actually think it's easily the better one. But then again, I do like the math problem Picard has with it, is that he's going to send the Enterprise-C to its death. If they stay in his timeline, they might have a fighting chance to live. Going back is a death sentence. But even if it does save many more lives, needs in the mini, Jean-Luc. What's Shooter McGavin?
I do not know.
Shooter McGavin.
Nope.
I wasn't going to let this one go. I saw the episode long before I saw Happy Gilmore. But now, when I watch this episode, I think of Castile as Shooter. That's impressive, since almost any other time I see Star Trek alumni and other things, then in my head, they've their Star Trek characters in that show. So in other words, I think what he's saying is he sees the Star Trek character in the actor anywhere else the actor acts. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So in other words, on Boston Legal, he's still seeing Captain Kirk, I suppose.
Well, it's completely Captain Kirk. And there was another show where Captain Kirk tried to play this police officer. It's always Captain Kirk.
Yes, TJ Prostitute. Castile and Yar seemed like a good relationship to me. They had commodities, so they were bound to hit it off. And I would think that being at war tend to accelerate relationships as we might die tomorrow kind of thinking. They don't have time to waste. That's one of the things I liked about Starship Troopers. Johnny, Rico, and Diz, whoever that is, would definitely have got together like that. Although this might just be me, I've always preferred Diz to Cameron in that movie. Johnny was a daft young boy, mind you. At that age, so was I. Now I'm off on a tangent. He sure is, because I don't know what he's talking about. I don't think I've never seen that. The problem I have with this episode is actually the famous line, "Let's make sure that history never forgets the name Enterprise." Yeah, it won't. Kirk made sure that long before this point in time. The Klingons respected him so much that they even knew all about the Enterprise, about the name Enterprise. It's probably in their song, so even if they did go on to stop both Enterprises here and actually wins the war, the name Enterprise still won't be forgotten. But still, it's a good line. It fits a moment perfectly. So that's just a nitpick. Her, he's getting the troops, so the lines work as intended, accurate or not. He's geeing up the troops. What does that mean? Her, he's geeing up the troops. You think it's a typo there? I'm not sure. And it was a good thing, too, because, yes, it takes an eternity for the Enterprise C to get through its time rift. Just how far away were they from it? As James rightly points out, this is a reset button episode. In fact, it's a whole point of the episode. I agree the reset button is too often used as a get out. But in this case, the plot points us to how this is an absurd mess that shouldn't be fixing the problem as we need to do.
It's not like the Year of Hell, for instance, where they absolutely have to destroy the Krennan ship. Yes, in that episode, things aren't what they should be, but they don't think like that at any point. They just want to stop Anorax before he makes things even worse. So they do. And look, that resets things. Oh, good. In that instance, and so often throughout the worst offender, Voyager, the reset button was a convenience rather than the goal. Funny enough, for all the criticisms of the JJ-verse gets, the use of the reset button to reboot the franchise is probably one of the good parts. Although it could have been argued that they didn't try to resolve the timeline to before Nero comes through, therefore saving Vulcan from destruction, then they're wrong. Or, to put it another way, you could say a bad point about the movie is them not using the reset button. Actually, hang on, let me just tangent here. I think that the reset button, in the way that they got out of the original universe and they went back in time and then were able to look at things again, I actually think that despite my problems with the 09 and Into Darkness films, I thought it was very respectful to get out of the main area and to tell their own stories in their own way. So I actually thought that was kind of the perfect way to handle the reboot. They kind of acknowledged that they came out of the, they acknowledged they were effectively given birth from the franchise as it's currently been up to now, but then it obviously gave them all the place to play with and all the stories to be told in whatever way they wish. So I was always very happy with that. Anyway, I've got off on another tangent, so I'll close by repeating what I said at the start. This is one of the best episodes of Trek across all 5 series. I love it, the plot is terrific, the action is great, and the decisions are all taken well. This is easily a 5 out of 5. Final aside now, did an F-bomb slip through the censors when talking about the podcast Lou listens to? I don't know. My list of podcasts that I listen to is pretty long as well, but it more or less breaks down into 3 categories. There's Trekmate, along with a couple of podcasts that Colin does. There's comedy, Kevin Smith features mainly here, and then there's soccer. I've even got my own soccer podcast these days as I took over as host of it in the summer. Quick plug, it's Scottish Football Forums podcast at SFF podcast on Twitter. Although if you do give it a listen to, be warned, I don't tone down my accent on there. Okay, what's next on my long list of podcasts to catch up on? So thank you very much, Kieran, for that. And obviously thank you for having appeared on the show earlier as well.
Well, then, obviously, if you heard an F-bomb slip through the sensors, then obviously I didn't take that out. So I apologize if I did, because I normally would take that out. Just like the Geordi's a dick thing. I take that out, or at least I try to. So the SFF podcast. Okay. Well, I'll follow it. I don't get into soccer whatsoever, but that's okay. You know, just like sci-fi waffle. I'm really not into sci-fi, but yet I do like the podcast. It doesn't matter to me. Okay, that's it, guys. Thank you again for some feedback. Please keep it up. We need it. We like it. We want it. And good night.
Good night.